This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
At 9:30, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg speaks with Sincere Shakur, who is helping to organize relief efforts in Far Rockaway in Queens, New York, where 10,000 people remain without power. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Dr. Helen Caldicott speaks on the medical and ecological impacts of the multiple meltdowns at Fukushima. And Lisa Graves of PR Watch talks about the power of the gun lobby. At 11 o'clock, it's The Food Show with your host, Kate Welch.
Hi, this is Joanne Hardesty. Join me on Thursday, January 17th from 8 to 9 for a conversation with City Commissioner Amanda Fritz. What are her priorities for this new term? What are your questions for her? Please join me on Thursday, January 17th from 8 to 9 for Voices from the Edge on KBOO.FM Portland.
On Wednesday, January 16th, KBOO will broadcast the talk by Michelle Alexander on the new Jim Crow, racism and the criminal justice system, along with a community forum on police and the Portland community. Listen to the talk live on KBOO Radio from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. this coming Wednesday on 90.7 FM and also heard on the web at kboo.fm.
And get together, break up this old Jim Crow. Break it up now.
Hi, this is Jennifer Kemp for KBOO's Radio Zine. I'm going to be speaking to Evelyn Olsultani, Associate Professor in American Culture at the University of Michigan, and author of the book Arabs and Muslims in the Media, Race and Representation After 9/11. Debunking the commonly held assumption that Arabs and Muslims have been portrayed by the media in an entirely negative light since the terrorist attacks of September 11th, Olsultani analyzes the insidious racism in our supposedly post-racial society. In the book, she explores popular television and news, citing many examples of Arabs and Muslims being represented in a positive way. Olsultani cautions us against seeing this as a sign of acceptance. Rather, these are merely token representations, creating a veneer of political correctness. Underlying racism still pervades the media and the U.S. consciousness. For more, here is Evelyn Olsultani on Arabs and Muslims in the Media, Race and Representation After 9/11. Hi, this is Jennifer Kemp for KBOO's Radio Zine, and I'm speaking tonight with Professor Evelyn Olsultani, author of Arabs and Muslims in the Media. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi, Jennifer.
Great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
You talk about how, since 9/11, there have been not only overt acts of racism towards Arabs and Muslims, but also acts of insidious racism portrayed in the media, although the United States is heralded as a post-racial society. Discuss the covert portrayals of racism.
What got me to write this book was that after 9/11, I was watching television. I was glued to my television, like many of us were, trying to figure out what had happened. And I was very surprised to see an increase in sympathetic representations of Arabs and Muslims after 9/11. And I was surprised for a variety of reasons. For one, it has been a historical trend that if the United States is going to war with someone, let's say during World War II against Japanese Americans or during the Cold War against the Soviets, it's common to demonize the enemy in order to justify going to war and killing the enemy. So I expected after 9/11 for there to be an increase in negative portrayals of Arabs and Muslims as terrorists, and I should note that there was definitely an increase. But the surprising thing is that there was also an increase in sympathetic portrayals. So my book emerged at that moment when I was trying to figure out what exactly was going on. Why, at this particular moment, would there be an increase in sympathetic portrayals? And a lot of people commented to me that they thought that the positive portrayals reflected that we're at a new moment, that we're not the same moment we were after World War II, where all Japanese Americans were rounded up and put in internment camps. that this was a new moment and that the United States would conduct itself differently, because we now know that they're not all the enemy. But I have found that that kind of reading is a bit too optimistic, because at the same time that these positive portrayals were being broadcast, there were instances, and many of them, of Arabs and Muslims being fired from their jobs, detained by the government, thousands of people at Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, being held without due process, without trial, without even being told why they were being held. Turns out many of them were innocent. So it seems to me that there was a discrepancy between the portrayals, how they're making us feel really good about our progress, and then the realities on the ground.
TV dramas like 24 and Sleeper Cell portray some Arabs and Muslims in a positive light. Even so, do you find these representations to be problematic? And if so, how?
So what I have found is that there is a new mode of representation that has emerged since 9/11. In the book, I have an academic term to refer to this. I refer to it as simplified complex representations, which is a term that refers to how writers and producers are trying to make their storylines and images more complicated. They're trying not to reproduce the same stereotypes of the past, but they tend to do so in a very simplified way. So we can predict them. We know they're coming. So this has meant that if a TV drama like 24 Sleeper Cell, if the storyline includes an Arab-Muslim terrorist threat, then we can be 95% sure that in that same TV drama, there will also be some kind of positive representation of an Arab-Muslim, Arab-American, or Muslim-American, seemingly to offset the negative stereotypes. So the idea here is writers and producers are trying to create more complex storylines and characters so that they're not accused of reproducing stereotypes. And I'm sure that some writers and producers genuinely don't want to reproduce stereotypes, given that we are in a new moment in terms of our cultural politics and society. But I have found that a lot of these kinds of strategies that are used are quite simplistic. I'm going to give you a few examples. So the most common is to insert a patriotic Arab American. And this is very common in 24, in Sleeper Cells, and in many other TV dramas. You have a terrorist threat, you throw in some kind of patriotic Arab American. Another common theme is to have a storyline about an Arab American who is the victim to a post-9/11 hate crime. So on Law & Order, on NYPD Blue, on a host of other TV dramas, The Practice, there were stories about Arab Americans who, for example, owned a store and their store is bombed, or who are denied flying on an airplane, or who are held indefinitely by the government. And it's a significant strategy because audiences, for at least a century, have been positioned to celebrate when the Arab or Muslim character is killed in a Hollywood film, because they're usually portrayed as terrorists. And so this is a wonderful new strategy where audiences sympathize for the Arab or Muslim character. But what I have found, and one of my larger arguments in the book, is that we can't simply approach these images around whether or not they're good or bad, positive or negative. If we read an image as positive or negative, then we can say, well, this is positive, and, you know, that's it. Well, why continue the conversation? But images do ideological work, so they actually produce meaning. So what I'm trying to do in the book is not just analyze an image about whether it's good or bad, but to say, well, how is this? What kinds of meanings are these images producing? So I've seen a lot of TV dramas that have a sympathetic storyline and a very sympathetic portrayal of an Arab or Muslim character. So, for example, there's an episode of The Practice where an Arab American is denied from flying on a plane. Then there is a court debate about whether or not this is reasonable or justified after 9/11, and one lawyer is arguing that it's unconstitutional and it's racist and it can't be justified. And the other lawyer argues that, of course, it can be justified. We're at a new moment after 9/11. National security is a concern. Safety trumps everything else. And the judge at the very end decides that it's very sad and remorseful, but because of the national security crisis, it is justifiable. So while we have a story that's very sympathetic, that makes you feel very sad at the end, ultimately, the storyline tends to support and justify discriminating against Arabs and Muslims after 9/11.
Okay, so you're saying that having some sympathetic portrayals of Arabs and Muslims, it kind of reinforces an idea that America is no longer racist, while still kind of justifying like an overall culture of racism towards Arabs and Muslims?
Yes, that is very much what I'm saying. That on the surface, it really makes us feel good, and it made me feel great. I felt very comforted by a lot of these images as an Arab American myself. And I just noticed a lot of people making comments that they really believe that our war on terror was distinct from previous wars that the United States had engaged in because we are so much more aware about racism. So I am arguing that these images, even though the hard part about this work is that this is an improvement. It's not that these images are horrible or that these writers and producers are doing some terrible thing. This is a significant improvement, but it just does not mean that we have arrived at this post-race moment where we live in this egalitarian society and we don't discriminate. The reality on the ground contradicts that. And looking at the images, for example, the patriotic Arab American or the victimized Arab American, we come to notice that it's not as if there are a diverse array of portrayals of Arabs and Muslims, but rather they fall into very narrow categories. So does a positive portrayal of an Arab American mean that they must be a staunch patriotic American or a victimized Arab American? So my hope is that in the future we'll see more diverse portrayals of Arab Americans outside of these two types, and also outside of the context of terrorism. Because my other criticism is, even though these representations are certainly an improvement from past representations, they tend to exist within a context of terrorism. So a question is, to what extent does this really make a difference if the characters we're seeing who are Arab and Muslim, whether they are good or bad, are existing within a context of terrorism? And my hope is that in the future we'll see more representations, diverse kinds of characters, and also outside of the context of terrorism.
You discuss the blurring of the distinction between news and fictional television in the post-9/11 media. How has this affected the overall representation of Arabs and Muslims in the American media?
So regarding this blurring, one of my questions has been, are these representations having an impact? These sympathetic and positive representations of Arabs and Muslims, are they having an impact? So what I did was I went into chat rooms, IMDb-type forums, to see what viewers of 24 and Supercell and NYPD Blue, Law & Order SVU, were saying about these shows that were portraying Arabs and Muslims. And what I found was that in terms of audiences and their comments, no one commented about how they now believe that Arabs and Muslims aren't terrorists or they now have rethought their stereotypes. Most of the viewers commented on the realness of the show, that 24 portrays some kind of realness about the war on terror. Audiences expressing dismay that Sleeper Cell was canceled because it shows the real terror that we're facing as a nation. So something that became very clear to me is that a lot of these efforts that writers and producers are trying to make in creating these complex characters is really not having the kind of impact that they would like. Rather, what most audiences are getting from these shows is about the realness of the threat and this blurring of the line between the fictional drama and the real war on terror.
I think you also talked about how there's kind of like a monolithic representation of Arabs and Muslims in the media, how the news media and like fictional shows like 24, NYPD, Blue kind of work together to create an overall picture. Would you agree with that?
So one of the things that I have noticed is that most TV dramas, I would say Sleeper Cell is the one exception, tend to portray Arabs, Muslims, South Asians, all as terrorists. So I found, for example, at the university with my students, that most students don't know the difference between an Arab, an Iranian, a South Asian, and it's not their fault. If we watch television, including the news media, these categories are often conflated and then often associated with terrorism. So that's another layer of an issue, that even though we have these very positive portrayals, that we still have this conflation and association of all of these identities with terrorism. Sleeper Cell was the one TV drama that made an effort to disentangle identities. So in Sleeper Cell, the Sleeper Cell members included an African-American, an Arab, Mexican, all-American white boy, French man. The issue with Sleeper Cell, apart from its various innovations, is that all of these identities were associated with terrorism, with the exception of the one patriotic Muslim who was the lead character, the African-American FBI agent. So it's very much, even though it's trying to distinguish itself from these other shows, it still tends to fall into the same trap.
Talk about the stereotype of the veiled, oppressed Muslim woman in the U.S. media. How has the stereotype furthered the U.S. agenda in the war on terror?
So what I have found in terms of examining this range of sympathetic or positive portrayals and the way that it makes us feel enlightened, good about ourselves, that we can distinguish between, quote-unquote, good and bad Arabs and Muslims, is that the figure of the oppressed Muslim woman plays an important role. So during my research, I looked through Time Magazine, Newsweek, CNN, and other mainstream media outlets, and I found an abundance of stories about oppressed Muslim women. And the stories are horrifying. Anyone who reads them would feel sick to their stomach. A lot of the stories were about female genital mutilation, women being beaten on the streets of Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia for violating the dress code, for not wearing their veil properly, women being sentenced to death for adultery or being beaten for disobeying their husbands. Just an assault of stories and evidence testifying to the oppressive and backwards nature of Islam. So I have found that this figure of the Muslim woman evokes a lot of sympathy from viewers, and that's part of this new moment, that we can sympathize with the quote-unquote enemy. So we can feel for the oppressed Muslim woman. There was an episode, Oprah Winfrey episode, a few years after 9/11, where she organized a million of her viewers to write letters to the Nigerian government to prevent the stoning of Amina Lawal. So this is an issue that really makes people outraged at the injustice, want to take action. And my argument is not that we should not be outraged, but something that really strikes me is the strategic use of these stories. So I have found that the oppressed Muslim woman comes to stand in for an explanation for the war on terror. So after 9/11, a lot of people ask, well, why do they hate us? And the U.S. government said, well, they hate us for our freedom. And then we had all of these stories about women who are not free, as if that would somehow explain 9/11. So in these explanations, we don't really get, in at least in mainstream explanations, that the U.S. government, for example, during the Cold War, played a crucial role in creating the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight against the Russians, and that this group later turned into al-Qaeda. It tends to be portrayed as something very distinct and separate, this terrorist group out there, as if the United States is completely innocent and doesn't play a role. And the United States' role during the Cold War helped set the scene for the Taliban to come to power. And the Taliban was in power from 1996 into 2001, and it was not an issue for the United States. It wasn't a reason to intervene in Afghanistan until after 9/11. So part of my examination is not that we should not be outraged by the stories that we receive about injustices, violence against women, but rather to ask about the strategic use of these stories. Why now? And why aren't we getting other stories that would provoke equal outrage about the U.S. involvement in the world? For example, during the U.S. sanctions in Iraq, the U.S. killed the figures very, very wildly, but many agree that the U.S. is responsible for the death of 500,000 children in Iraq. That's very outrageous to me, but this is not part of the usual cycle of stories that provoke outrage. Also, when looking at this question of oppressed Muslim women, we forget the fact that 1 in 4 women in the United States are victims of rape and domestic violence as well. These stories make it seem as if nothing bad ever happens in the United States. And finally, a lot of these stories overlook the fact that there are intellectual and feminist debates going on in Muslim countries. There are feminist movements in Muslim countries. Even in the late 1800s, Qasem Amin advocated for reform for women's rights. It's not a new thing. There's a book by John Esposito and Dalia Mogahed called Who Speaks for Islam, and their study shows that the majority of Muslim women don't see Islam as an obstacle, but rather they see patriarchal interpretations of Islam as an obstacle. So part of what I'm trying to look at here is how does our sympathy and outrage for these stories about oppressed Muslim women also feed into us feeling good about ourselves, feeling enlightened. We care about them. But then at the same time, if we assume that this monolithic woman, all these Arab and Muslim women are being brutalized, then it means the men are brutalizing them. And it means that if thousands of men are held at Guantanamo Bay without being charged, it's an easy slip to assume that they're all guilty. If they're not guilty of terrorism, well, then they're probably guilty of oppressing women and should be held and mistreated anyway. So I see the figure of the oppressed Muslim woman as part of this larger trend of complicated images, this new multicultural moment that also helps us not acknowledge the full reality on the ground.
Yeah, that point that you were just bringing up about sympathetic portrayals of Muslim women versus highly unsympathetic portrayals of Muslim men, with the implication that they are brutalizing Muslim women. That brings me to my next question, which is, while Muslim women are often portrayed as worthy of sympathy in the American media, Muslim men usually are not. Talk about the relationship between Muslim men and deviant sexuality in the media.
So in my research, I was looking for how is the media explaining terrorism to the public? And so one narrative I found was they hate us for our freedom. That was a very popular one. Another recurring narrative was about oppressed Muslim women. And then a third was about Muslim men explaining that they are involved in terrorism because of some kind of failed heterosexuality or some kind of sexual frustration, because presumably Islam is repressive. And I remember, and I write about this a little bit in my book, I remember watching Bill Maher shortly after 9/11, and he's known for being progressive, but when it comes to Arab Muslims, he has a lot of things to say that I disagree with. And he made the claim that the way to win the war on terror is by getting Muslim men laid, that Muslim men are so repressed that they are acting out and behaving violently because they are deprived sexually. And he was not the only person to make that kind of argument. And what I did was I analyzed how the violence of John Walker Lind, who was a white American who got involved with Al-Qaeda. He's now in prison. He made headline news many years ago, and I wanted to look at him and compare to some other men. I also looked at Jose Padilla, a Latino man from Chicago, known as the Dirty Bomber, to see how their stories are told to the public to explain terrorism. Why did they get involved in terrorism? And the stories tend to focus on some kind of link to failed heterosexuality. So it begins by saying that John Walker Lind grew up very privileged in a hippie town, liberal town in California, but that he was never interested in girls. And then from there, it goes to say he became interested in Islam, that he used to sleep in the same bed as his male Muslim teacher and dreamed about having a life with him. And there are all these very subtle references to his sexuality, to the possibility that he might be gay. With Jose Padilla, it was a little bit different. And in his case, there are references how he grew up in a Latino barrio where there were gangs, and he was a part of a gang, and he married somebody, and later on he left his wife, and he married a woman from, I think she was from Syria, and there's a photo of her, and she's completely covered. And it seems to make the suggestion that he wanted an oppressed woman. So a lot of these narratives about Muslim men and trying to explain why they're involved in terrorism tends to focus on some kind of issue with their sexuality. They're becoming gay, or they're failed heterosexuals, and they're somehow sexually repressed, and this somehow explains why they're involved in terrorism, when if you look at what many of these people have stated, for example, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, when he testified in court before he was imprisoned, he said that the reason he was involved in trying to blow up an airplane was because the U.S. had killed children in Iraq during the sanctions. I'm not saying that justifies what he's doing. I don't support terrorism under any circumstances. But why don't we get that explanation? Why doesn't that count as an explanation that the public should be exposed to? So I found that the kinds of explanations we're getting for why terrorism happens tend to be very dissatisfactory and focus on this idea that Muslim women are oppressed and that somehow causes terrorism, or that Muslim men have some kind of failed sexuality that also explains terrorism.
So you think that people are focusing too heavily on gender and sexuality issues instead of actually focusing on real, like, substantive U.S. foreign policy issues?
I do, indeed. I think that somehow this focus on gender and sexuality stands in for other explanations that are more real and also more threatening. So a real explanation that does not circulate as much would be discussing in more depth how, during the Cold War, and Mahmoud Mamdani's book, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, documents this history, how the United States, during the Cold War, engaged in proxy wars as a strategy and didn't directly engage in war, but rather created what we would today consider to be terrorist groups. These were groups that were not necessarily affiliated with the government, but non-government groups, and funded them and gave them arms in order to prevent the spread of communism. So there was a mutual interest, for example, in the case of creating Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda had an interest also in defeating the Russians, and the United States had an interest in defeating the Russians, but it wasn't an issue to the United States that this group of people who had a very rigid interpretation of Islam could perhaps become dangerous later. And this is absent from the mainstream kinds of conversations about understanding 9/11, understanding why terrorism happens. And these kinds of explanations are more threatening because they place greater accountability on the United States. And these other explanations completely exempt the United States from having to take any responsibility.
Well, we're getting to the end of our time today. So do you have any final comments that you want to add about the book before we go?
I guess that one thing I would like to add is that this mode of representation that I'm pointing to, where you have a positive and negative portrayal together, that it's common with all ethnic groups, but it became very obvious with Arabs, particularly after 9/11, and that before 9/11, there were maybe two films that come to mind, The Siege in 1998, and Three Kings in 1999, that included a positive portrayal of an Arab-American or Arab in the storyline, but that after 9/11 it's become a trend. It's become something you can expect. It's not an exception. It is the rule. And it does reflect that we have changed as a society. That half of the viewers who are watching TV dramas, they don't want to see stereotypes anymore. The other half is fine with the stereotypes, but at least half of the viewers don't want to see them. So writers and producers are responding. And I think the fact that writers and producers are responding says a lot and also gives me hope that if writers and producers are changing their storyline to try not to offend the public because they want as many viewers as possible, then more change is possible.
Again, I've been speaking to Evelyn Olsultani, author of the book Arabs and Muslims in the Media, Race and Representation After 9/11. For KBOO's Radio Zine, this is Jennifer Kemp. Thanks so much, Evelyn.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
One, two.
KBOO Radio is proud to help sponsor the Portland Old Time Music Gathering, taking place from January 16th through January 20th at various venues across Portland. The Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering is a grassroots, volunteer-run festival that aims to celebrate and enrich the community of traditional, old-time Appalachian-style string band musicians. A list of performers, locations, and more information can be found at kboo.fm/2013oldtime.
And now KBOO's Jenka Soderberg speaks with Sincere Shakur, who is helping to organize relief efforts in Far Rockaway in Queens, New York, where 10,000 people remain without power.
I'm speaking now with Sincere Shakur, who is an organizer with Occupy Sandy. It's been almost 3 months now since Hurricane Sandy hit the coast of New York and New Jersey. What are some of the ongoing impacts for people in particularly Far Rockaway and some of the outer areas in New York?
The biggest problem that I see right now is